Hi, my name is Frank Marasco. I'm a principal consultant at Microsoft Consulting Services, and I'm also a core team member of the Patterns and Practices group. And in this video, we're going to be discussing transformation guidance from farm solutions to add-ins. Some of the topics that we're going to be discussing today is what does a project look like when we're doing this transformation of your farm solutions? What is included? We'll talk about the assessment, some of the key things that should be included in your planning, and then implementation details. Then we're also going to discuss that transformation approach and replacement approaches from actual learnings that the team here at Microsoft has been working on for the last 2 years on actual projects. The key, right, is getting those learnings from our field on how we actually perform this type of work for our customers. And then finally, right, we'll talk a little bit about, if you're still using farm solutions today and you're still going to be developing those in your on-premises SharePoint infrastructures, what are some of the things that you should look out for to prevent those headaches, right, when you move to that next version of the platform or move into Office 365. So we talked about some of the learnings from various projects here at Microsoft and from the field, from the community. One of the first things that you want to ensure is that you have a detailed inventory of what solution packages are actually deployed to your farm. If you have the code, that's great. We should have that code. Hopefully you have that somewhere. And then we'll talk a little bit about some of the tools that we've used in the following slides that will help you analyze and inventory how many web parts or content types, lists, definitions, and fields that you have deployed. So we'll show you a great tool that will help you jumpstart that. And one of the important things here is understanding the end goals, right? Understanding the user experience. It's more than just code. And one of the things that we have found out when we're doing these assessments is we look at the code, but and then we talk to the end users and they're not using the code as we thought they were. We would understand that some of these actually features aren't actually being used or even haven't met the business requirements. So that is also an important step. And then finally, right, is understanding some of those impacts with those farm solutions. And I'll be honest, right, there are some cases of a bad headache. We'll talk about those later. But if you have custom fields that you have deployed within your solutions, what is that impact to those users? Or if you have custom service apps, there are some things that are very painful, and that might actually lead to a content migration. So let's talk about what this transformation process looks like. We call this the five-step program, and this has evolved over the 2 years, so the names have changed, right? But the first step when you begin a project like this is to understand, what is that readiness, right? Are our developers familiar with add-in techniques and remote patterns? That is a key before you actually start doing this development. It's not just taking that code and rewriting or refactoring to the add-in model. It's more than that. So, making sure that the development team is very familiar with those remote techniques. And if they're not, go out and visit Patterns and Practices. We have a lot of great guidance out there to help you learn the remote patterns. One of the big things, right, with readiness is, we have different types of, add-ins available, right? And, if you're developing a provider hosted add-in, what is that hosting platform? Is it Azure? Is it on-premises? Or is it Amazon? What some of the things could actually affect the solution design and the logical architecture of your solution. If your hosting platform is out in the cloud, and does it need to talk to on-premises data or data sources, that will also play a key because that might change in how you architect this solution. You might have to use ExpressRoute or, VPN or Service Bus, and understanding that is a key. So that will actually help you in your solution planning. The solution assessment, step two of the program here is to, leverage some of the tools that we'll be showing shortly on how to analyze and gather that inventory of all the features that the solution packages have. So you want to analyze those one by one, and that's a great start of how to determine how many web parts and content types, list definition, fields, etc., that I have to deal with. The next phase is actually probably one of the most important phases. We look at the code, we understand what is happening and then the assessment, we got our inventory, but then we start doing demos with our site owners, and we notice that they're not actually using the system as that we thought they were. So we're looking at the code and then all of a sudden, well, oh, I didn't know that that's how you were using it. And then this will give you the idea, right, is to, hey, are these features actually still being used or not, right? Or, you'll get a sense of, hey, you have this widget web part. This could actually be replaced with an out-of-the-box script part, as an example. So understanding that would also be helpful. One of the interesting things that, when I personally was dealing with this with our customers is we actually found out that some of the features that were developed were actually didn't really meet their needs. So that's why the demo is actually pretty important. You'll also perhaps might learn that, hey, this feature never really worked the way I thought it would, and I would like to do this. So this is a great step to actually understand and finalize and define those business requirements before you start writing your code. And then, then we start moving. Once we have our solution planning done, we have an idea of the business requirements. We have an idea of what our logical design looks like. Now we'll get into that development and testing phase, and this is where we actually define our technical approach on how we're going to transition the existing farm solution into an add-in model. And this will actually define some of the actually necessary components that we might need when we're actually doing the development. And then the last step, finally, right, is once we're all done with our testing and user acceptance testing, now we get ready for deployment. We'll possibly might have to transform existing content if you had farm solutions and or if you have sites that are dependent upon those farm solutions, that we have to transform that content. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next few slides of some techniques of how to transform some of the existing content. And then the last step is finally being, farm solution free and retract your solutions. So I talked about some of those tools that actually can help us with our assessment and our inventory. And, when we first started 2 years ago, we reached out to the SPCAF, the Code Analysis Framework team, and we've actually talked to them and actually got a free version and a migration assessment version to actually help our customers and our field actually get that assessment. So this is actually a great tool that will help you with your inventory of all your artifacts that you have in your solutions, and then actually provide you some helpful tips of what you might have to do from a migration assessment standpoint. So it will provide you some links to patterns and practices and various Microsoft blogs on how we transition or what is the best practice to, replacing, like a web template, for example. How do we do that in the new remote patterns? The other thing that actually came out of working with this team is we actually open source, and this is all under Office Dev. They actually included additional code analysis framework rules, and you can actually go out and download these rules, and this allowed us to get, faster development cycles, and we were actually getting contributions from the community across the globe and feedback. And so this is actually a great project that will also help you out with custom rules. And if you want to join us on, creating those transformation rules, go out and check this out. It's aka.msspcaf MA rules. Submit a pull request if you have a great rule that you want to implement and share. So this is a great opportunity to actually help the community help us. So let's talk about let's show the SPCAF tool in practice here. All right. So I have SPCAF loaded. And what I'm going to do is I already ran a few packages, but it's actually very simple to actually get this going. So let's find a solution package. So we have the Contoso Internet package. We're just going to drag this on, and then we're going to start building out our analysis. And this takes some time. So what this is doing right now is it's actually going through and dissecting the solution package to look at how many elements and that we're dealing with. It will also do code quality and for critical issues. So this could also help you with your development. And what we have here is we can actually see that we have a few critical roadblocks, and we have some medium severities. We also get how many feature elements and scope and solution artifacts that are actually included. We get our inventory of how many elements are actually documented. And it also gives us into any type of external dependencies. So if you're leveraging a third-party component in your farm solutions, it will also identify what those external dependencies are. So if I go into the roadblocks here, what this does, right, is, now it's telling me that, oh, I'm using the feature framework. I have five of these. And what it will do is it will describe what that full trust approach has been, and then also give you what that the app add-in approach. And it will also provide you various links. So if I'm using the feature framework, this will take us to the patterns and practices samples, and then also show us some type of provisioning, different provisioning techniques that you can use. We also see that we have a critical one here. This is a web template. This solution is actually deployed at the farm level. We don't want to do that any longer. So the recommendation here is to use a custom provisioning engine to actually remotely provision those. So this is a great way to get some guidance on how you can actually transform your existing artifacts. It will also list out how many content types so that we can see that, hey, we're dealing with five content types. We've got a few modules. My favorite is list definitions. We'll talk about that. And so this is a great way to actually start jumpstart to help you understand what we're dealing with before you get into that next phase of, analyzing the business requirements and doing the demos with your customers. Okay, so let's go back to the presentation. So let's talk about what are some of these techniques that we can use to actually transform these solutions. We basically have two different types of approaches, and we have our in place and our swing. We have these today when these options have always been available to us. We're upgrading from 2010 to 13, 13 to 16. Do we do it in place or do we build out a new infrastructure? And there's pros and cons to each one of these. And so this is something that you would have to ensure that you measure to understand which is the right approach for your customer. So one of the things, right, is if you're doing that in place approach, where you're going to remove the farm solution dependencies on your existing sites, one of the things that you can do, right, with an in place approach is you can start with, once your add-ins have been developed, you can start all your new sites to start leveraging the new add-ins and remove that farm solution dependency. There is less customer impact with doing an in-place upgrade because we have less hardware and tooling that is required. If we go with, a new environment, for an example, we might have to leverage a third-party migration tooling. So that is something that you would have to think about. And each one of these could have an impact to your users. If we do a new environment, URLs will change. There could be increased downtimes for our users, based upon the approach. The biggest thing, one of the cons that we have, discovered with an in place is, leveraging the feature framework, there could be, increased possibility of orphans. And, the moral of the story here is make sure you deactivate your features before you retract, because what you don't want to do is have to pull out that code and redeploy to your infrastructure or use a different technique of actually creating those features in a stub, solution package and deploy that and deactivate. So, make sure that you definitely deactivate your features and test your transformation process in a dev environment before going out into production. The other thing too is, the execution time from could be a little bit longer when you're doing an in place. It's not that big bang approach. What, that could also be a benefit too, because what you can do now is stage so many different sites. So, say you have 1,000 site collections that need to be transformed. You can actually plan and schedule those so that you're not affecting an entire user. So that planning is very important. The hardest part, right, is tracking that progress. So how many sites do I have left? Where am I at in the process? So careful planning, is definitely needed in that case. So some of the ways that you can minimize the overall transformation time is, you can leverage server-side techniques to actually perform those operations. One of the things that I found that was very beneficial to speed up the process is to introduce multi-threading, parallel processing of sites. So you can scale this up by adding threads to process the transformation process. But one of the things that you have to ensure, right, is with too many threads could actually cause performance degradation in one farm, and your end users could experience other challenges with performance. So we're going to talk about some of the different types of customizations and how, and what are some replacement options for these. This is not all encompassing, but these are one of the big, some of the features that we have seen. These are we're going to be talking about those. We're always continuing on enhancing our guidance. So again, make sure that you watch the patterns and practices to get the latest guidance. So we always continue by working with the community and the field to always enhance our guidance. So make sure you follow that. So one of the biggest challenges is, we talked about evergreen sites. So if I'm developing my new add-ins, all new site collections and sites can actually be full trust code free. But what about those existing sites? And based upon how you created your artifacts, right? If you declared if you created those declaratively, like your content types and site columns and list definitions, that actually introduces additional challenges. And we'll talk later about some ways that how you can mitigate that into the future. But this is the existing site is could be a challenge. Specifically the those content types and fields. One of the things too, right, is how if you're using master pages and layouts, right? So if you're using a portal, a publishing portal, how do we get those features out there and then start removing the FTC dependency? Is some of the techniques that you can do is gradually reduce. So say for example you have your features out there, we can actually introduce with remote operations new page layouts and master pages that these sites can be used. So we can have our provider-hosted add-in with all our necessary assets and configuration and branding. We can either execute that with PowerShell, or we can actually use a remote timer job or C Sharp to actually deploy those to the SharePoint to your SharePoint sites. One of the other things too that we have actually seen is sometimes there even on collaboration sites that we enable the publishing features and to get a little bit extra UX, capabilities. I would actually recommend against doing that and not activate those publishing features, because there are different ways of how to introduce branding artifacts like your master pages out on that site. So go check out the patterns and practices on various techniques and how not to leverage the publishing features for your collaboration sites. The replacement of your web parts and user controls, you'll find that this is a very similar, right, as we go through this, that everything is a remote operation to replace a master page or a layout or replace with a web part on a page. You can also replace with pre-configured out-of-the-box web parts or leverage app part instances or leverage JavaScript embedding or app script parts to actually reduce the amount of customizations of custom web parts that you might have. One of the things too is based upon the approach, right? So if you are deploying your add-ins, you might have to enable side loading. There's two different types of techniques to actually deploy a SharePoint add-in. One is tenant scoped, which is deployed out from your app catalog, and you can target specific sites. But app parts and custom actions will not be registered with a tenant scoped app. So you might have to enable side loading on your team site or your publishing site to actually get that customization out there. This kit by default with a developer site, app side loading is already enabled on that site. And if you can actually enable this on other site types, but you can only do this with CSUN by activating the feature. And what we can do here is we have our provider-hosted add-in that will go out to that site, enable side loading, upload the necessary app package, and then disable that. So that is another technique of how you can actually get your web parts or your customized pages out there. So let's go over a little sample of how do we enable side loading. So in this code is available out in Patterns and Practices. It's the core side loading. This is the feature that you need to activate on your site collection. So you'll need this GUID. A lot of this code is just wiring up the client context, so it looks like a lot of code, but this is actually the core of the method here. Is we have an extension method called process feature, which is going to enable side loading. And before you do this, right, you want to ensure that whoever is executing this code has tenant admin permissions. This has to be a user account. You cannot use app only tenant permissions to enable this. It actually has to be a user account. And what we're going to do is, we're going to have our app already packaged and deployed, and then we're going to use the load and install app, passing in that stream, and then we're going to load and execute query. This will actually enable the feature and upload that app. And then one of the most important things, right, when you're doing this is you want to ensure that your code handles exceptions appropriately, because what we want to ensure is that that feature is deactivated once we're performing that activity. So if we didn't do that, a site administrator can actually take an app and sideload it themselves. So if they're reading the Patterns and Practices blog and they see this, they would be able to sideload their apps as well. So it's not really a security concern, but it is more of a governance and how those apps get deployed. So ensure that you actually disable this feature when you're all done. And before we finish up, here is one of the things from a guidance perspective, is I would not sideload SharePoint hosted add-ins, because that will create an app web. And if you're creating some lists and libraries in there, that could introduce some data loss. So, the recommended practice here is to actually only do this for provider hosted add-ins, and make sure that you grant your app that you are deploying the necessary permissions. Make sure the app regnew is defined, and you go into app INV to register the appropriate permissions. So let's go back to the slide. So site columns and content types. One of the interesting challenges, if you created these declaratively using the free feature framework, and you activated these features on every single site to actually deploy those content types, you are going to have to leverage a third-party tooling to actually perform that migration. If you created those content types via code, what happens is now that that information is actually stored in the content database instead of the Hive. So we actually remove some of those dependencies. So you can actually retract. This is a known issue. The product group is aware of this. Right now, we're currently working on a plan, or we have a plan in place to actually address this. So keep following Patterns and Practices for the latest information. Before we move on, right, one of the interesting things is if you leverage the content type hub at all. So say, for example, you have created your content types declaratively, and you push them out to the hub and publish those. In that case, those content types are actually pushed down into those sites. So when we actually unpublish that content type from the hub and deactivate our feature and then retract our solution, it would actually make local copies in that site. So that is one thing that could actually save you from performing a content migration. And then what you would want to do here is, if you want to re-leverage the content type hub and control those content types, what you would do is leverage remote patterns, use the same content type IDs and field IDs that you have, and run that code and have them run on the content type hub, and then publish out those content types. So that is something that you also want to think about in your planning. So the assessment is a great way to actually find out that. So think about that before you retract your solutions. Modules with the feature framework is basically in these files are actually deployed to your site. And the common theme here is follow that remote provisioning pattern. They could be web parts, page layouts, master page. There's a couple things that you could do when you're actually transforming this, is that you can unghost those files. You can either enumerate those files and copy them and update them, which will make it an unghosted copy. Or you could that or create new ones. And when you deactivate your features, you can then delete those files and copy again. So that is just another technique that you can leverage. Site templates and web templates. These are something that you really have to think about with using site templates and web templates. They're not the real problem. The issue comes in is to what features and artifacts that these templates are using. So you have to ensure that you analyze those and understand what features are included in those templates. And then you would replace those artifacts with a remote pattern. So you can safely, retract that feature that actually deployed those site templates and web templates. But it's those features that you have to worry about. Timer job. Well, there is no ability to create and manage timer jobs, in a typical fashion. However, there are other different type of techniques that we can leverage, and you probably read about the remote timer job patterns, where that is actually running outside of the SharePoint processes. So you can still access SharePoint and other services using remote patterns like CSOM and REST. You can actually schedule these jobs to execute on as an as needed basis. If you're hosting out in Azure, you can actually leverage Azure web jobs to control that scheduling. And based upon what if it's a governance like timer job, a remote timer job, you can either use a specific account with the appropriate permissions, or leverage app only tokens to actually perform that operation. If you're hosting in an on-premises world, what you would do is, leverage your favorite scheduling program to kick off that application, or you can create a Windows service. I kind of lean towards leveraging your favorite scheduling program. My favorite is the AT command to actually schedule that job if you're going to be hosting in an on-premises environment. So one of the things, and this has caused us many problems with customers and upgrading back even, from 2010 to 13, is you need to deactivate your custom features before you retract. If you don't, your next CU or service pack will fail. And then you'll have to go back and either redeploy that solution or create a new solution with that feature ID and have that deployed so that you can deactivate. So we don't want to leave any orphans behind. This is another case of a bad headache. And speaking of bad headaches, what actually makes Frank in SharePoint sad is leveraging custom field types, site definitions, list definitions, moving publishing sites to non-publishing sites. You shouldn't be really doing that anyway, but if you had to, all of these actually require a content migration. So when you're using custom field types, that data is structured in a specific way that your app only knows about. So probably leveraging different techniques instead of using a custom field like a JS link, perhaps, to actually code what that look and feel of that control should be, probably would be a preferred option. Custom site definitions, there's nothing that we can do about that. Once we deactivate or retract these solutions, that Hive dependencies have been removed, then your site will be broken. The exact same thing goes for custom list definitions. Once I retract, you should deactivate first. Once you deactivate your list definition, your list will still continue to work. But once you retract, you will now make that list inaccessible to your end users, and you would have to redeploy that because of the dependency. So each one of these will require a content migration. So ensure that you plan, if you have any of these artifacts deployed, and you're doing an in-place upgrade, you'll probably have to do a content migration or possibly leverage a swing process. When moving to Office 365 from an on-premises environment, some of these are mitigated because you have to do a content migration anyway, so we can have our new add-ins deployed to that environment and perform that content migration in flight after our add-ins are deployed. And we have done that at various customers, and that has actually worked out very well. So I'm moving to the cloud. Do I have to transform as part of the move? Yes, you do. There are a couple things that you can look at. If you're just wanting to get out there and just dump your content in, then that is acceptable, right? Based upon your requirements. But what you should actually do is understand what farm solution that you have. Do you still need those features out in Office 365? You can actually work in parallel while you're planning your migration and developing your new SharePoint add-ins, and have that deployed out to Office 365, and then you perform that content migration. That is actually less risky than combining both of those at the same time when you're doing the move. So think about that approach, and try to, I always prefer the less risky approach to a project. So we're still doing, say you're still doing farm solutions today. What are some considerations that I can give you is the recommended pattern is to, for content types and site columns and list templates, is actually create those programmatically. If you're doing list templates, we have a sample out in Patterns and Practices, the ECM document libraries. Leverage out of the box list types. Don't create your own. That will reduce the dependency upon the Hive. And the other recommendation, and is this will allow you to avoid that future maintenance work or rework of your deployment. So think about that when if you're continuing on building your farm solutions, follow the best practices. I would actually create those programmatically. Visual Studio gave us great tools to do that declaratively, but we ran into challenges if you ever had to upgrade, and we did have residue in the Hive, which actually prevented our content from actually rendering properly. So the content types, what is the challenge with content types and site columns? Rather than using that feature framework, provision those site columns and content types using code. Why do we do this? These objects are actually created directly within the database in an unghosted manner, without any dependencies on the file system or in the Hive. How would you go about doing that? You create your feature receiver and create your necessary artifacts, and programmatically create those content types and fields. If you continue on doing leveraging the declarative approach, you'll notice that we have our manifest XML with all of our elements. We will actually have that element file that it represents our content type, and what would happen is that we'll have a dependency on these XML files in the content database. So once we retract the solution, the content type is still there. They would be removed. Your content will still be there, but if that content type or field isn't going to be used, that field will actually be removed. The best and recommended approach to reduce your future maintenance is to actually create those programmatically. So we still continue going on with our manifest. We use our favorite language to actually, in our feature receiver, actually create those necessary content types, which will then get directly added to the content database. And here you can see that we do not have a dependency, within the file system. So we can safely retract this solution and we will not have any data loss. So with list templates, you should avoid them. Leverage out of the box list IDs. Don't create a custom one. It does have a unique identifier in the schema XML file, which resides in the Hive. And once you retract that list will be unusable to your users. So consider using code to provision those specific instances, and leverage existing lists or list types instead of creating your own. The custom field challenges, so the moral of the story is don't use them. Don't use custom fields in your farm solutions. If you do, what would happen is that data is actually stored in that content database and will have a dependency on that field type, and this will actually cause migration challenges for you in the future. So you might have to massage that data and write code to pull that out and work with that. Consider only using field controls for presenting that data, or leverage client-side rendering to present that data in a different way instead of using custom field types. So some of the recommendations, right, is ensure that you have that detailed inventory before you start rewriting code. Just don't pick that up. Leverage SPCAF to help you assist with inventorying and identifying technical issues earlier. Ensure that you work with your site owners and your business partners to understand what those requirements are. Do the demos, see how they're leveraging the solution. That is a great way to ensure that you have alignment when you start your development efforts. And perhaps there, right, you won't have, you might have new features. Or new functionality that you would want to introduce instead of those features that no one used. And the most important thing is to understand the impact to your users. If you have custom field types and list definitions and content types, what does that mean for your end users? Understand that impact so that you can plan accordingly. With that said, please go out and visit Office Dev PNP, where we have tons of sample and we always are improving our guidance. So check that out. Join the Yammer group. Thank you very much for listening to me. I hope you enjoyed the session.